Okay, Raghavan actually wanted to start us off. This is Raghavan, by the way. I work with him, and cool guy.
At least he says so, probably because I'm around. Anyway, as Elliot said, I'm Raghavan Srinivasan, and both of us work at VMware. I'm actually a program manager, which essentially translates to I don't really do anything and just run people around. I don't really code, and Elliot does all the cool work anyway, so I just wanted to kick things off to set some context for why we are here, because some people may be wondering what the heck is VMware kind of doing, you know, at LCA. So first of all, to give some context, it's because we got a free trip to come to Australia. Cool. you don't say no when your company wants to send you to Australia. But on a serious note, though, we've actually been doing a lot of really interesting work, at least from our perspective, instead of VMware, in enabling cool solutions on top of Linux running in a virtualized environment. And a lot of people don't really know about this work, primarily because, you know, we haven't really gone out and reached out and talked about this stuff. And the Open Virtual Machine Tools Project, which is what Elliot and I and a bunch of other people inside of VMware work on, is probably one of these first of several initiatives that we actually want to bring to the community and also make sure that we collaborate and learn from the community. So we wanted to, you know, use an opportunity like this at what is probably one of the best Linux user conferences and the Linux community conference to actually come and talk about the Open Virtual Machine Tools Project and hopefully give you an idea of what VMware has been doing, as well as learn from you in terms of, hey, here are all the other things that are happening, and, you know, how can the Open Virtual Machine Tools Project, you know, maybe contribute cool ideas to the community, as well as learn from things that the community is already working on. So what we're going to do is actually just start by describing a few terms that may provide some context for how we describe things inside of VMware, because, you know, when we talk about things like host, guest, private, and things like that, there may be slight differences in how the community as a whole understands those terms and how we may be using those. So I think we're going to start by just describing some of those terms so people understand what we actually are talking about when we mention those. And then we'll talk about the project itself and all the cool new features that have been developed and released as part of the Open Virtual Machine Tools Project. And that's where we're going to spend the most of our time actually talking about the technical details. And it's in this space that we actually want to find out, okay, hey, you guys have done it this way, but, you know, do you know how Xen and KVM are doing these things? And, you know, why haven't you done this? So we actually want to learn what those things are so we can actually find out, you know, how to improve the Open Virtual Machine Tools Project. And then finally, we give a quick overview of, you know, where the project is at, what the status of the project is at, and you know, where we are looking to take it forward. So without further ado, I'll just turn it over to Elliot, and you can take us away.
All right. Raghavan, can you kick us over to the right slide? That's what we're going to be talking about. I'm going to assume pretty much you guys know what these terms mean. So a couple of them, like host and guest, are generally more used in the VM world than, say, the Xen world, where you have DOM 0 and DOM U, things like that. A monitor is sometimes called the hypervisor by other people. It's all the same general blob of stuff. Paravert, I guess the main thing I want to point out about that is there's a lot of different definitions of that, and for the purpose of this presentation, I'm going to be calling it any operating system where the core functions of the kernel are modified to work in a virtualized environment. And so something like Xen is obviously an example we think of when we talk about Paravert. But there are other things that we do in the Open Virtual Machine Tools that could be called Paravert by some people, and I just don't happen to call them that. Tools is, when I say tools, this is what we're talking about through this whole presentation, these Open Virtual Machine Tools, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about what they are. The main idea with the Open Virtual Machine Tools is that there's a whole bunch of cool features that you can enable by adding software that runs in the guest. In the virtualization world, we sometimes talk about having a totally transparent virtualization experience, where an application doesn't know whether it's working in a virtualized OS or whether it's running directly on the hardware. And the main idea here is that, yeah, that barrier is good, creating that virtual world is good, but it also impacts the user experience. So the tools exist and they run inside the guest to help break down that barrier in areas where it's appropriate. And I think that's one of the main ideas I want to get across today, is that there's this cool set of features that you can enable by adding this stuff that runs inside the guest. And that doesn't seem to be something that the open source community has been really strong in so far with the virtualization efforts. I really don't know of any tools for KVM. Well, I'll talk about that later. I don't know of any tools for Xen and any equivalent project to this. So this provides a unique set of functionality. And again, this is different from Paravert. And one more thing, this is a lot about user experience. There's a lot more soft stuff going on here. There's no like hard algorithm problems or anything like that. It's more about improving the user experience, dealing with various performance issues that have room for improvement and so forth. Let's go to the next slide. Here's some of the features that the Open Virtual Machine tools provide. I guess the way to think of these is to think about an example user. We have this guy who really likes Linux, wants to run it at work, but he's in a company where they don't have the same religion, so to speak. They really, they run Exchange, Microsoft Exchange, for their email and calendaring and all that junk. And so in order to survive and feed his family and avoid going to the poorhouse, he's going to use Exchange and Outlook as a client. And so in order to deal with this situation, he chooses to run Windows in a virtual machine while continuing to run Linux on his desktop. Now, that's great and it's okay, but the tools make life so much more convenient for him because he can drag a file from his Linux host straight to Outlook and it just works. He can access all his files from inside the Windows guest. He can access the Linux host files and it all just works. Resource management, it means it performs acceptably and there's some performance improvements that you see because we have these extra features provided by the tools. There's a couple of APIs as well provided by the tools, and those more interesting to the developers, I suppose. Drag and drop. So I was going to try and have all these fancy demos going, like three screens and all that, but our schedule got shuffled up and I didn't have quite things prepared in advance. So imagine, if you will, drag and drop. It's something we all know about. It's really kind of mundane to us at this point. But when you add virtualization into the mix, you have the problem of being able to seamlessly drag between these various worlds that you're running, between your guest and your host. And the tools enable you to really break that barrier. You can get rid of that problem. It just works. And so what's happening behind the scenes, if we can just jump through the next few slides, we have the host and the guest talking back and forth to coordinate this drag. In this example, it's from the guest to the host, and it's talking about all the operations that are going on. So, you know, the host realizes that the guest might have dragged the mouse out of the screen and it's talking to the guest and there's all this cool stuff going on. And I'll back up. Okay, so the main idea is behind the scenes there's communication going on in order to make the user experience seamless. Another example use case that's the flip side of the one I just mentioned is what if a company wants to migrate from Windows to Linux? I mean, I think we all want that to happen, but realistically, a company can't do that all at once. So in order to make it easier for their users, they migrate one application at a time, and then they use some of these integration features to really make things seamless, and it just makes life simpler for their users. Interesting technical issue, the timeout. Imagine if you're transferring a really large file. You've drag and dropped a 10 gig DV tape image, or you drag and dropped a DVD image or something like that, and it takes a while to transfer. So this is an example of one of the thorny technical issues we've run into so far, and one area we're always seeking feedback in for improving the whole situation with the tools. We need more ideas, basically, to continually improve things. What's going on is that GTK has a 5-minute timeout. If it's a source application for a drop, it has a 5-minute timeout between the time it is told a drop has completed and the time that the destination application replies and says, I'm all done. And this is fine in almost all cases, but in the context of virtualization, it breaks down because we have to do this huge long file transfer before we can actually say the drop has completed. So if we can go to the next slide, the workaround we have in place right now, it's called VMBlock. It's a kernel module. It sits on the target side, so it can be running either in the host or the guest, actually. What VMBlock does, basically what happens is when we're dragging this huge DVD image or whatever, instead of waiting for the file transfer to complete, the drag destination will talk back to the drag source and say, okay, I'm done transferring, I'm done the drop, even though it hasn't quite finished yet. And meanwhile, VMBlock will be running on the target side to prevent any applications from accessing this file until the transfer is complete. This matters if you want the target application to actually get some data that makes sense. And so we have VMBlock, it just puts processes to sleep when they try and look up this file. And then once the transfer is finished, they can go right ahead, they can play their movie, mount the DVD image, whatever is needed. Here's a few other possible solutions we've looked at. We really don't know if there's other ones. By the way, you guys are welcome to shout out with questions or whatever at any time. We'll also have time at the end. But yeah, we're definitely interested in discussing different ways to solve this problem in the future. Let's see. Let's see what's next. Okay, HostGuest file system. I should have mentioned also, in addition to drag and drop, there's also cut and paste, which is more or less the same thing, but it does cut and paste integration. So you can cut in the host, paste in the guest, vice versa. And again, the idea here is make the user experience seamless, bridge that gap between the host and the guest where it makes sense. HostGuest file system is another way to bridge the gap. It commonly shows up in VMware products anyways as a shared folders feature. What that means is any guest application can access folders or directory trees that are shared from the host selectively. You're probably, it's also used for drag and drop transfers behind the scenes and copy and paste behind the scenes. You're probably wondering why we use this instead of NFS or CIFS. And NFS and CIFS both would work fine, but they're really not the best suited to this particular application. They really don't fit quite perfectly into this use case. So some specific examples of that, HDFS doesn't need networking running at all. It'll work even if you're rescuing a system or something like that inside a virtual machine. It's cross-platform. For example, I can have a macOS host and a Linux guest, or a Windows host and a Linux guest, or a Windows guest and a Linux host, any set of combinations, and it'll work very nicely. It's faster. Let me check the performance numbers I wrote down here. The other day I tested reading a 512 meg file from a Fedora 8 host to a Fedora 8 guest, and I ran a few test runs up front and just to prime the cache and all that. And then after that, I got 4 megabytes a second over CIFS, 6 megabytes a second over NFS, and 12 megabytes a second over HDFS. So that's a fairly substantial performance difference, and that's another reason why HDFS is relevant here. Finally, imagine using NFS for this solution, or Samba. You'd have to have a daemon running. You have to have a way of editing the config file and restarting the daemon and all this stuff. It'll just be really complicated. With HDFS, we can have a little library, and the both the server and client are linked nicely in with other processes that are already running to provide virtualization stuff. And it all just works. You have a nice user interface. You don't need to go muck around with config files. So again, this goes towards improving the user experience. What else? It's basically just like any other file system. You have open, read, close. You know, it just has a bunch of standard operations. It works over the backdoor and RPC, guest RPC communications mechanisms that I'll talk about in a little bit. We're going to have a demo. If you'd like to come down afterwards, I can probably show it on my laptop or something like that. But it looks roughly like you have an NFS share mounted or anything else. It just has those different characteristics that I talked about. Okay, let's see what's next. Yeah, we have a cheesy screenshot here just to show, hey, there's some software that's user visible. But a lot of the tools are really behind the scenes. Their whole purpose is to be invisible and to make virtualization invisible. Toolbox lets you do things like connecting and disconnecting various devices, shrinking. I'll talk about disk shrinking in a little bit. Let's see what's next. Chug. Memory ballooning. Any of you who have worked on KVM may have seen recently the patch that was added to implement this feature for KVM as well. And that's great to see that going in there, because VMware was a pioneer of this whole approach to dealing with resource management. The basic idea is that the guest is the place that knows best which memory the guest would like to free up first. We could write software that's running in the host, and it looks inside this virtual machine and looks around the data structures and decides, okay, we can get rid of this page first, and we can allocate that to another virtual machine. But realistically, it's so much simpler just to let the guest OS make that decision. What happens is that there's a kernel module running inside the guest, and when the host wants to have some memory back, it'll just talk to this vmem control module and say, hey, give me some memory back. And vmem control will allocate some of the guest RAM, and it'll basically hand it right back to the host and say, okay, here's this chunk of memory I allocated. I'm specifically not going to use it. And instead, you can go use it for other things. It could be other host applications. It could be other virtual machines, and so on and so forth. And meanwhile, the guest gets this memory pressure and swaps out the stuff it really doesn't need, and all is well. And of course, this is not permanent. The host OS can tell VMem control to release the memory, and then the guest OS gets it back to use for whatever other things it wants. Yeah, let's see what's next. Disk shrinking. So disk shrinking is kind of like memory ballooning. From the guest perspective, we don't really want to shrink the disk, and that's not what disk shrinking does. But what happens is that sometimes there's deleted files that don't represent any real storage, that don't need to be stored, but they're still there taking up space in the guest disk image. So what happens is that toolbox through that little GUI you saw a couple slides ago, someone will go in there and say, shrink the disk. And toolbox will start writing a file filled with zeros. It keeps writing that file, and if we go to the next slide, it'll show it fills the disk with zeros, basically. All the free space is filled up with zeros. And then, once all of the space is full, it'll talk back to the host and say, okay, go ahead and shrink the disk. And the host will look through the disk image and decide, okay, here's all these places filled with zeros in the disk image. I don't really need to store them. I don't need to have them on my host disk at all. And so this way, it just saves a lot of disk space when you don't really need to store that extra junk. And again, this is a great example of how applications running inside the guest tools can really help improve resource management, can improve user experience beyond what the host could do by itself. I mean, imagine the other alternative solution. You have a application running on the host that has to parse the ext3 file system, NTFS, HFS plus, whatever other file systems. And it would be really complicated, and you couldn't have the virtual machine running at the same time, and there would just be a bunch of other crazy problems with it. So this way, we have the guest help us out in shrinking the disk. Now, it should be noted again, this is not the same as changing the file system size. This is really just a matter of discarding the sectors in the disk image that aren't really needed. Yes, sir?
Couldn't that cause a problem
if there was this?
It does.
Yeah. I'm sure there's tweaks that could be made. For example, you could fill all but a megabyte or something like that. And I don't know exactly whether that's already implemented or not. But certainly you want to be careful how and when you run this disk shrinking operation. Because, yeah, if applications run out of disk space, they can get kind of cranky. So it does have a downside in that particular respect. It doesn't actually resize the file system. From the guest perspective, the disk is the same size as it was before the shrinking operation. It's just that on the host side, some of those sectors aren't backed up by any disk space on the host because they're just zeros. We don't need to store them. Yeah, it's automatically will make that space again on the host side. Sir?
Does it actually write zeros to the disk, or is it kind of more efficiently by passing across the list and marking sectors, passing that information back to the disk?
Right now, it's implemented as actually writing zeros. That basically takes advantage of some other features that are already on the host side for disk management, where you basically have copy on write style of managing the various pieces of the disk. So it just automatically works through that mechanism, more or less. It could be more efficient to avoid writing all those zeros if you had a way for the guest to communicate with the host about actually which sector is which and which is unneeded. But even then, That approach, running the guest, would require a more complicated implementation on the guest side. So it may or may not be worth it. I don't know.
So at the moment, it doesn't have to actually write a physical disk?
I believe that's correct. So on the host side, it wouldn't have to write a new sector to the disk.
So,
yes, sir. Can you explain a little bit?
Some file system has compression mechanism, right?
Right.
So when you write zeros, you need to load it zero, right?
Yeah. It does assume that there's no compression going on like that. But in that case, the compression on the guest side would probably be roughly equal to the disk savings that's happening on the host side here. So it should be no difference as far as the space usage after you're done. Yeah, encryption's a great example. And that may be a situation where this disk shrinking stuff could be improved. For example, a gentleman's suggestion of actually having the guest communicate specific sectors back to the host, that might be a way to deal with encryption. And there's trade-offs for each approach, but right now this is really simple, and it works great for getting rid of the stuff that doesn't need to be stored. Correct. Raghavan's going to talk more about the project towards the end, and so we'll have a URL up and all that stuff. I guess the main idea here is, even if it weren't open source, there's stuff that would make sense for KVM and Xen and all that, and as a bonus, we've got open source code out there right now you can download.
So is this a superset of the VMware tools that you currently install?
I believe it's a subset, but it's like 95%, 99%. Is it ThinPrint that's not in there?
So to answer that question as well as your question, all the VMware tools for Linux, BSD, and Solaris that VMware owns the copyright for have been open sourced. There are one or two proprietary components that other people own the copyright for that we haven't open sourced yet, but we are actually trying to work with them to see if they would be interested in open sourcing those as well. But everything else that you get is open source as far as VMware tools is concerned. Now, OpenVM tools, the project itself, is not shipping yet because the branch that we have released to SourceForge is a newer development branch, and it hasn't been integrated back into any of the VMware products yet, but that's also something that we're trying to fix so that the OpenVM tools are actually the tools that are shipped as part of VMware tools when you get them on Linux or any other Unix host.
I think currently all the virtualization solutions, like, well, at least Xen for HVM and KVM, and even now Xen for Paravert, are using the QEMU device model. So it makes it a lot easier to implement all those features and everybody just benefits. Why isn't there any plans from the VMware side to use QEMU as a device model to implement all those features? In a way, everybody benefits instead of just trying to, well, get some inspiration from your tools.
Right. There's a good answer for that, but I'll save it to the end because there's like a little bit of stuff. I mainly want to get through the rest of this technical stuff. We can talk more about the project because it does sound like there's definitely room for cooperation. You know, I personally wasn't aware that QEMU had a driver model, for example, and it would be cool if there was some overlap there. Okay, let's see what else is up here. Clock. So sometimes the clock gets out of sync between the host and the guest. And this isn't just a little bit. Imagine suspend and resume where the guest is basically stopped running for hours or days. And so we want to synchronize it again. Click. And yep, now they're in sync. Now, some of you may be wondering again, why didn't we use NTP? NTP is great if your clocks are roughly in sync and they drift a little bit and you want to get them back together. It's not so great if your clock is jumping way out here and then jumps this way, and some other things that happen under suspend and resume and other scenarios in virtualization. So we have just this way to force the clocks back together. And then once they are back together, you don't need NTP either, because the timer virtualization should take care of that. I don't know how many of you are deep into the technical details of how timer virtualization works, but and it's also not so relevant in a paravert environment. But basically, the hypervisor takes care of keeping the timers approximately synchronized between the guest and the host.
Mm-hmm. I've had serious problems with clock
drifting. All right. Now, I don't have all the answers because I work on the tools, not in the hypervisor. I do know that the tickless thing was actually a nice thing for virtualization. For example, it means you don't have to run the timer handler 1,000 times a second, as far as I understand it. And there's some other benefits. It's not perfect, and there's always some scenario where they're going to drift out. But on the hypervisor side, I think the intent is definitely to, minimize that drift while still having 50 or 100 virtual machines running and each of them in sync. So there's things like catch-up interrupts for the timer and all these type of things. I don't know if that answers your question. Okay. Okay, so we've got another resource to manage that the tools help with, the clock. Let's see what else is up. Fix API. There's a couple of things that the tools do to help developers. Vix is something that lets you write programs that run on the host to manipulate virtual machines. I guess this is kind of like libvirt, but it's focused on one specific virtual machine, and it may be a bit more featureful in that aspect. You can do things like powering on a virtual machine, resetting it, jumping between snapshots and things like that. And there's a couple of features that really require the tools to help out, like running a program inside the guest OS. That's something you could do over SSH, but again, you need networking set up and accounts working and all these other things. And so the tools can help here by creating a fairly foolproof way of doing these various operations inside a virtual machine. And a virus control tool. How would that work?
Well, I run the VM tool on the outside on some other machine, and suddenly I've got the ultimate way to control the
guest. You'd need another part to run outside, like on the host side. In VMware's instance, that's called a command called vmrun, or the Vix library that you link to. But yeah, you'd have, with the cooperation of the tools, a way to run programs inside guests and stuff like that, and kill processes and list files, and there's a whole bunch of stuff you can do. Guestlib, I think, is next. Yeah, so this is about retrieving performance statistics in a virtualized environment. You can figure out how much memory is this virtual machine actually using and stuff like that. And I guess this might be useful if you're writing an application that figures out, is this virtual machine getting its fair share of resources, for example? Is it performing the way it should be, given that we're running on this actual hardware? I think that's about it. Is there anything? Oh, cool. So behind the scenes stuff, you've heard about all these features, and there's actually more. I have a cool demo up here if people want to look at it after. There's various features that the tools provide that are user visible or affect the user. And then behind the scenes, there's this communication stuff that has to happen between the host and the guest to make it all a reality. How are we doing for time? Okay. Backdoor, that's the lowest level mechanism that we currently use. It's basically like a system call from the guest to the host, I guess you could say. What happens is there's these registers you stuff with magic numbers, and you do this I/O operation to an I/O port. Now, if you were running this directly on physical hardware, it would kind of blow up or bomb out. But because we're running inside a virtual machine, the hypervisor intercepts this and looks at the command that's specified by those registers and runs it and sticks the results back in the registers. And so there's some examples of various backdoor commands that happen to be implemented in VMware's products. Getting the processor speed, connecting and disconnecting your CD-ROM, changing the mouse position, stuff like that. And especially the tools use quite a few of those things, like getting the system time probably used as part of the time synchronization feature. A guest-to-host RPC is another layer on top of the backdoor that gives us a few more features. And it's used by a lot of the tools. If we can go to the next slide. It's basically a very simple and basic RPC mechanism. You have a command string. You have arguments as a binary blob. And then you run the backdoor command to do the RPC call. And you get back the results. Host-to-guest calls are a little bit more thorny because there's no way for the hypervisor to interrupt the execution of the guest operating system with an incoming RPC call necessarily. It would be entirely possible to implement it using some other solutions, but given how the backdoor command is implemented right now, where it's an I/O operation, there's really no way to interrupt the guest operating system. And so as a result, we have to do polling by the guest for incoming RPCs. So guest RPC, it's there, it's okay, but we have something coming up in the future that deals with problems like this polling one. And well, let's talk about it. It's called VMCI, a virtual machine communication interface. The idea here is basically fix all the problems with backdoor and guest RPC. For example, it's not really possible to extend the backdoor mechanism and add a new backdoor call. VMCI lets applications just start listening for requests. It, from the application's perspective, it works kind of just like normal networking. You make a socket with a different address family and protocol family. And you communicate using datagrams and streams. At the low level, like from the guest perspective, it looks kind of like a PCI device. And then underneath that, it's communicating using shared memory and queue pairs. And yeah, anyone can use it to implement virtualization-aware applications. It doesn't need polling because it's just acting like a standard networking protocol, so you can wait to receive data on the socket and stuff like that. And it should be really fast, faster than TCP IP or whatever between guest and host. So this works between any two applications inside one guest, between different guests, between guest and host, between two host applications. It's just a general framework for passing data around really quickly. And that should go a long way to resolve some of these problems with the backdoor and guest RPC. Okay. Raghavan, can you tell us a little bit about this whole open source project?
Sure. So I know we have, is it 3 minutes, Alan? Okay, so we have about 3 minutes, so I'll try to quickly just walk through these slides. Some of the questions we already answered, but I do want to make sure that we leave at least a couple of minutes at the end for any other questions. So the project, as we mentioned, has been open source, so it's essentially an implementation of VMware Tools. It's actually the exact same code that VMware Tools is today, and the project is available on SourceForge, openvmtools.sourceforge.net, and as I mentioned, almost all of the VMware tools have been open source, except for the ones that VMware doesn't own the copyright for. The components are all licensed under GPLv2 or LGPL for the user space components, and there were some BSD modules that we used that we've made changes to, but we've kept the original license as well. All the code is currently being hosted on the SourceForge.net infrastructure, and this is something that we're actually likely to change in the near future to be self-hosted. One of the main reasons is, we're still trying to figure out what's the best way for a lot of the VMware engineers to also start working on a more community-based project. And one of the things that we found out is that SourceForge has provided really good infrastructure, but a lot of the tools that they use don't necessarily translate well, and we want to make sure that we use things like Git and things like Bugzilla that we use pretty extensively instead of VMware, so that both the VMware engineers as well as the community can work together on tools that are probably more in line with what's being used today, as opposed to some parts of the SourceForge infrastructure which probably haven't been updated in a while. We're also finding it extremely difficult, at least at this point, to keep some of the code synchronized between our internal repositories and the external repositories. So we're actually looking for ideas and help on how to manage this. Our end goal is to move to a direction where all of the development actually happens on the open source project's infrastructure. But we aren't there yet. So in the interim, we do need to make sure that we can keep these different code bases synced so that VMware products that actually ship actually have bits inside VMware's infrastructure as well. And why did we open source them? Well, I don't want to be flippant, but it definitely was the right thing to do, because all of the inherent benefits of an open source development model is something that we are really interested in taking advantage of. And one of the main reasons we are here is to actually engage with you to understand, okay, you guys ought to be doing these things differently, or if here are ways where we can actually collaborate together. One particular thing that we are really interested in doing is bundling in Linux distributions. And we know for certain specific Linux distributions, there are strong policies, and for all the right reasons, that say, for example, all the kernel modules should be upstream. So how do we make sure that the kernel modules that are part of the tools are actually going to get upstream, and what are the things that we have to do? So these are things that we probably have some information on, but we really want to learn and work with you to understand what VMware and the OpenVM Tools project specifically have to be doing, so we can actually make this more usable. Because I think once the tools start getting bundled in distros and people start realizing this, and kind of have this better out-of-the-box experience, it makes life easier for a lot of the users, as well as Elliot mentioned, because now users get better user experience, and we want to make sure that the open virtual machine tools enable that. So
hypervisor stuff.
One of the other things that we specifically want to work on and really understand what we can do better is to see how the tools can be reusable by other hypervisor platforms. And when I say reusable, not just ideas, but actual code as well. So you don't necessarily have five different implementations of the ballooning driver, for example. So we really do want to understand, and that's the main reason we are here, to actually talk to people outside of this specific talk, but in and around the conference, to understand what we ought to be doing better.
To
Yeah, so I just want to quickly wrap up by saying, in the meantime, you know, here are ways you can contribute. You know, just use the software and you know, file bugs and feature requests and tell us what is working and what is not. And then specific areas where we really would like your help is in, you know, reviewing some of the kernel modules and saying, this kernel module is never going to make it upstream. You know, that is partially useful, but if you can actually tell us, here are the things that you need to do to actually get this upstream, that would be really useful. So specific examples are here, and I'm sure you can think of a lot of other ways how you can help the OpenVM Tools project be successful. So with this, I'll just stop and pause for any questions in the remaining minute or so we have.
Any questions, ideas, comments?
Yes, sir. Comment, which is the family of tools and Linux pieces would be nice if it sits in the system, right?
On Linux, I don't know if the toolbox shows up in the system tray. Right. So that's something to fix because it's that type of thing that should sit there. I don't know. Do you want to do that coding? it's a good idea. I don't know when I'll get to it, but I'll give it a shot. I saw another hand or two. Okay. In that particular situation, it will work because the toolbox does not have to be running in order for copy and paste and drag and drop and other stuff to work. There's two or three processes that are working behind the scenes. There's guestd, which is per system. There's VMware user, which is per user's X11 session. And then there's the toolbox, which is like a little GUI that pops up. So in that case, you're drag and drop will work and all that. And I think there was another hand back there. It's not any different really, but it's more common in a virtualization scenario because you have to transfer the whole file, whereas in the traditional scenario, the file is already there, and you just, when you complete the drop, you point the user at the URL to that or the path to that, and it's right there on the file system. So it's not that it's not a problem anyways, but it's a lot more common in virtualization because you're always doing a file transfer.
Thank you.